You are listening to The Pilgrim on the 405 with Will Crist. Join him as he and his guests discover how businesses thrive in California.
Well, welcome to The Pilgrim on the 405.
We're going to be talking today with a new friend from North Carolina, Dusty Staub, a speaker at TEDx conferences and a consultant and counselor who focuses on courage. So, Dusty, welcome to The Pilgrim on the 405.
Great. Thank you very much. It's great to be here with you.
Well, tell us a little bit, Dusty, about how tell us a story, a wonderful story about your dad, about how you got into this whole notion of what courage is.
Oh, gosh. If I can do the short version, my father grew up in the Depression. He was a football player, had a full scholarship to Notre Dame. 1942, didn't go, fought in World War II, in the military, the Army, a paratrooper for 26 years, 500 career jumps, fought in World War II, fought in Korea. And his nickname in high school was Blood and Guts Staub. So when he got out, he just got even tougher. I'm the oldest of six. He was the oldest of four. His father was the oldest of 10. So you have an oldest son of an oldest son of an oldest son. You have football-playing family. You have a warrior. And I was more of a poet.
Not a lot of expectations in that story, right?
A lot of expectations. So I was a huge disappointment to my father. He and I were at odds with each other from the age of about 3 or 4 on. And I was working in the VA hospital and working as an intern there. And one of my patients was dying of esophageal cancer. And I got to spend about 6 weeks, almost 2 months, with him and his family. And I was with him at his bedside when he took his last breath. And when I saw what the daughter was saying to her dad and what his wife was saying to her husband, I realized that if that was my father, who was about that old, if that had been him, I couldn't have said any of those things. And that I was walking around as kind of a pissy, self-righteous 28 going on 29-year-old, and that I'd had a pretty easy life compared to my dad, and that I needed to not only cut him some slack, but I needed to have the courage to change my behavior, but I wasn't going to change him. And that's where the 7 Acts of Courage was born. And when I really worked on changing my behavior and my orientation, lo and behold, within 3 years, my dad began to change. For the first time in my life, told me he loved me, began to appreciate me, began to say, before that was, give up that psychological bullshit and go get a real job. And so about 4 or 5 years into this process, I get a phone call from him, says, Stop, yeah, Dad, how can I help you? He says, son, I got a problem with one of my salesmen. I was wondering if that psychological bullshit might be helpful. Well, turned out it was. So, that's a short version of it.
Yeah. Okay, so out of that come the 7 Acts of Courage. So tell us what the 7 Acts of Courage are.
All right. Well, first, Will, what I'd like to say is that courage is a big word, and it comes from the French word cœur, meaning heart. So when you're talking about courage, you're talking about finding your heart. And I think courage is in short supply right now in many boardrooms and across this nation and in the world. But at any rate, courage is monolithic when you look at it. And what I discovered working with families, working with individuals, in my writing, in my consulting work, is that there are different acts of courage. So I'm going to walk you through 7 distinct acts of courage. And you're going to be strong in 3 or 4 or 5 of them, but there's going to be 1 or 2 that you've least developed. And the 1 or 2 you've least developed is what trips you up every time. So the first act of courage is the courage to dream and to express the dream. And it takes courage because we've got so many cynics in the world, so many critics, so many naysayers, internet trolls who are willing to dump on anybody's dream or anybody's possibility. So people don't dream or they don't express it. And doesn't become real till you begin to put it out there. The second act of courage is the courage to see current reality. Okay, my dream is I want to be a best-selling author, and current reality is I've never written a book, and current reality is I was terrible in English, And current reality is I'm working 50, 60 hours a week, and I don't have time to write a book. So you have to admit and be honest about the current reality and still say, and my courage, my desire is to, I want to be able to still write a book. So current reality is the foundation from which you move towards your dream. But it takes five more acts of courage to move forward. Does that make sense?
Yes.
So the next act of courage, if you want to move from current reality to the dream, is you have to have the courage to confront. And the Quakers have a wonderful way of saying this. They say, telling truth to power. The essence of the courage to confront is willing to tell truth to power. That truth to power could be a secretary. It could be your boss. It could be your spouse. It could be a teenager. It could be a powerful motor on your team. If you don't have the courage to confront, to speak your truth to power, you'll never move your current reality towards your dream. But that's not enough. Because if you will confront, but if you lack the courage to be confronted, and I deal with a lot of senior executives who will confront, but many of them have trouble being confronted. So they, if somebody comes in to hurt their feelings, they in essence punish them, or they don't want to hear it, or they shut them down, which means that they're going to be blindsided. And there's a phrase that a consultant who worked with me for many years, actually was president of my company for a while, Joe Judge, used to say, he said, look, when somebody comes to confront you with criticism, they're inviting you to join a conversation that's been going on for a while. And you either make it safe for them to tell you, or you shut them down, and they just go back and redouble that conversation behind your back. So would you rather be behind your back or to your face? It's one or the other. And if you make it safe for people to come talk to you, the conversation is behind your back, drop down. Well, the next act that's required is the courage to learn and grow. And that means giving up the need to be right. Now, you probably don't suffer from this problem, Will, but I'm a recovering writaholic. I got it from my father, who got it from his father, and I learned that if you weren't right, you're wrong, and if you're wrong, you're nothing. So I had to retrain myself to say, you know, I don't have to be right about everything. I don't even have to be right all the time. I just need to focus on the bigger win. What's the thing I really want here? And very often, we go after a win, insisting on being right, when it's really the booty prize. The second part of the courage to learn and grow is being willing to step into ambiguity and to the unknown. And a lot of people are afraid of that. You know, new startups are at a historic low here in this country right now. People are afraid. They're afraid to take that risk to step out there. And yet, the biggest generator of jobs has been startups and small business. So we really need to find that courage again. The next act of courage is something Brene Brown has made very popular with her TED Talk. Millions of people have seen it. I've been talking about it since 1998 when I wrote my second book, is the courage to be vulnerable. Vulnerability is absolutely essential to feel love, to feel joy, to innovate in a business. In fact, some of the most powerful CEOs I've worked with have had the courage to be vulnerable, and they let people know they need them. They're open to the wild ideas, the energy, and the creativity of the people around them. And that's when people start to blossom. And finally, the seventh act is the courage to take action, but it's action that's now informed by the dream, current reality, confronting, being confronted, learning and growing, and being vulnerable. So when you act with greater wisdom and greater insight. And I've seen this transform individual leaders. I've seen it transform teams. And it can transform an organization when people really turn on to it.
All right. So tell me a little bit about what a team or an individual would be feeling when they didn't have these, you know, the courage to do these seven things.
All right. So one of the things we do is we come in and we help build high-performance teamwork in organizations. And high-performance teams are teams where there is a sense of psychological safety. And, in fact, Google just did some research on these highest-performing teams at Google, and there are a lot of smart people at Google. The highest-performing teams, the number one factor was a sense of psychological safety. That is, people felt they could be confronted, and they could confront, but it didn't feel like a personal attack. And that means you can have vigorous intellectual debate. So when we go into organizations, we'll often find people who've been punished by leaders in the past or afraid of speaking up, or we have leaders or we have individuals who won't listen, they get defensive. And what that does is it creates friction. It's like sand in the gears. And it slows the team down. It stops intellectual debate. And so instead of focusing on the best ideas and coming up with the best idea for the organization, you fight, have individuals fighting over their best idea or individuals with better ideas not saying anything because they're afraid they'll be laughed at or belittled. So without the courage to confront and be confronted, and without the courage to be vulnerable or open to each other, teams really can't reach that high-performance level. And again, the fancy term for that is sense of psychological safety. So that's just one example, although we also have some teams who've gone into where they didn't have the courage to dream. They were waiting for the rest of the organization to tell them what to do. And my advice to everybody is don't wait for someone to tell you what to do. Look out, see where you can create the greatest value. Go and let people know what you're going to do to create that value, and then do it. And force your organization, force your boss to react to you by seeing you as someone who is positive and working to take things off their plate and solve problems they didn't even realize were there. And when you become proactive that way, and you activate these different forms of courage, your power, your influence goes up, and you get far more permission in your organization.
Well, now, would it be safe to say, would you agree with me that these acts of courage are the facilitators of results, that these are ways of achieving results?
That's a beautiful phrase. I love that. I'm going to use it. No. I think the acts of courage are facilitators of change. They're facilitators of effectiveness is another way to say it. And I love that phrase, Will.
All right. So if they're facilitators of change or helping to make change effective, it seems to me that what we're looking for, number one, is rather than looking to get my way done, we as a group are looking for truth.
Yes.
We're looking for what is actually the case. We're looking for what we agree will solve the problem that we're discussing right now. Now, a prerequisite of that, I agree with you, is the psychological safety. And that's where I was a little concerned about the focus on courage. And maybe I misunderstand what courage means, but this notion of the courage to confront somebody who is in an argument. And I'm curious about how an argument would ever help a company move forward.
Well, an argument which is unwarranted conflict does not help. Warranted conflict is you have one idea, I have a different idea, and you and I are engaged in an intellectual debate over which idea is better, and in the process, willing to explore, come up with an even better idea than either of us have. Now, that's warranted conflict, and that's healthy. In fact, an organization which doesn't have warranted conflict is not much of an organization.
Mm-hmm.
I was trained as a marital and family therapist, and if couples didn't learn to fight within the first year or two of marriage, their chances of being divorced after 10 years was almost double that of the those that have learned to fight.
All right. Now, the fighting there, to me, I mean, this is the question I have. In that marital conflict, are they looking for who is going to win the argument, or are they looking for what is the best way for us to move forward?
Well, in a healthy couple, yes, we're looking for the best way to move forward. For many couples, it becomes a matter of insisting on being right. And that's where that courage to be vulnerable comes in, and the courage to learn and grow. But what I would say is that in many organizations, a lot of what we really promote is vigorous intellectual debate that is not personalized, that is always focused on what's the best answer for the organization. And let's not run with the first good answer. Let's really examine and be willing to have the courage to be more innovative here. There was a recent, you may be aware of this, a recent Chief Executive Magazine cited an IBM Global study of CEOs that said fewer than half of the CEOs can handle increased complexity. They're not ready to handle all the conflict and all the complexity that's out there, and they're trying to apply simple solutions to where they need to innovate. And so you have to have a lot of courage to admit, I don't know, I need help here. Mm-hmm. It takes a lot of courage to say, you know, I know we can perform better. I don't know quite how to get there. Let me get some help. So I think courage is absolutely essential. Now, one of the things you said that I would follow it, if you and I are in a state of conflict and you're my boss and you're a control freak and you just want your ideas to win, then my arguing with you is probably career limiting.
Yes.
In which case, if I've got talent, I'm going to vote with my feet and go someplace where somebody is willing to listen to me and engage me. And that's what a lot of millennials are doing today.
Well, let's talk about this limitation. It's career limiting for the person. Fair?
Yes.
And it's also it is opportunity limiting for the business.
Absolutely. And so what happens is, you know, and the research says that engagement. The Gallup organization has talked about how powerful engagement is. And engagement is based on whether people feel valued, whether they feel listened to, whether they feel cared about, and whether they feel that they can be effective. And if they have those things, they tend to be much more engaged, and those organizations with higher levels of engagement are consistently more profitable, consistently more robust, and more resilient than organizations that don't. And the interesting research here, Will, is that people don't quit organizations, they quit supervisors. So I might love your organization, but if you're not listening to me or you're not treating me respectfully or you're always insisting you're right and I'm always wrong, I'm going to quit you. And I'm going to go work for a supervisor in another company where I can really shine. And so you lose out, your organization loses out, and I probably get a raise moving to another organization, which is the way it often works out.
Right, and to me, in working with managers, what I tell them is that people might tell you that they are leaving because there's more money. But the real reason they're leaving is one of two things, or maybe both. Either there's no longer a challenge for them. They have reached
right.
the top. They're hitting the ceiling, and they don't see any opportunity to move forward. Or they do not believe that their supervisor, their manager, is seeking to help them be the best they can be. They don't feel like they're on their side.
Yes. Yes. Well said. Totally agree.
All right. So to me, we're talking about shifting the way that an organization communicates, the way that an organization makes decisions, right?
Yes, we are.
To me, one of the... Well, I'm an implementer for the Entrepreneurial Operating System for EOS, and one of the things that I found so fascinating about this process in helping companies move from the top down, authority makes the decisions, and then we'll just tell everybody else what to do, and then get frustrated because they don't do it, to the leadership team taking responsibility for achieving the vision of the business, which very often is the vision of the owner, or the CEO, but taking responsibility for that, buying into it. And then when we make decisions as we're dealing with issues, it's a very interesting way I found that EOS suggests people work on making decisions. Number one is don't proceed to the conversation about how to solve it until you understand what the real problem is.
Yes.
So often people take off and try to solve the superficial, the symptoms, because they're easier, or because they haven't taken the time to understand what the real issue is, or the real problem is. So first, let's all agree on what the real problem is, and that may take most of the discussion time. Secondly, when we begin to talk about the problem, discuss it, suggesting possible solutions, the person making the suggestion about proposing a particular solution only gets to talk about it once. Because if they talk about it more, they've begun to politic. to get people, attempting to get people to believe them. But go around the circle of the table, and everybody can talk about all the different solutions, but they can only talk about the one they bring up one time. That's a change in the way that we approach decision-making.
Yes. Yes, it is. And many organizations aren't ready for it. They're not ready to embrace complexity. Many organizations don't have the leadership that has the courage yet to really be open enough to hear different ideas like this. And so, you know, what you said is kind of a process we follow. So don't chase symptoms, do root cause analysis.
Mm-hmm.
So the first thing is this a symptom or is this a root cause? And so you have that first discussion. Before we try to come up with any solutions, let's say we can solve 1,000 symptoms, but we actually go backwards. We solve one or two root causes, we have really done something.
Yeah, and we eliminate so many of the other pieces that all the symptoms are gone too.
Exactly. And then the second thing you talked about is what we call consideration, which is you offer an idea, you get to argue it, put it out there, and you make sure that it's been heard.
Mm-hmm.
But then there's consideration given to everybody's idea.
Mm-hmm.
And we do something a little bit different after that. We say, all right, now, Will, you had a great idea, and Sally over here had a great idea. We want you to argue Sally's idea with all the passion you can. I want you to get behind it, and Sally, you're going to argue Will's idea. So we do what we call point-counterpoint,
mm-hmm.
and people step into the other argument. And when they argue that other perspective and try to persuade from that, it forces the thinking, it expands perspective, and begin to see new options and more creative options. Then you have a debate. All right, we're solving a real problem. We've looked at a lot of different ideas and possibilities. What do we see now? Is there something we haven't seen, a better solution than anything we've talked about, or is there a way to put together several of these into something truly elegant?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And then you get into the artfulness and the creativity of true innovation in terms of the process of improving your functioning of your organization.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think those are helpful articulations of the process that I see happening in companies that I work with. Those things do happen, and I thank you for those specific articulations, because I think that would be helpful to help them understand what they're doing.
Yeah, yeah. And I would say, Will, it takes courage, though, to hear and listen patiently to other people. It takes courage to have someone attack your idea and not make it personal. And it takes courage to put your ideas out there or to put someone else's idea out there. And it takes courage to be open, realizing, you know, for me, the courage to learn and grow is the realization none of us is as smart as all of us.
Right, right. Well, you know, what we call the step of courage is we call entering the danger.
Ah, yeah.
Entering the danger. I haven't used the term courage in working with leadership teams, but we do talk about entering the danger. And I suppose that does take courage to do it. We just talk about that's the task, is to enter the danger. Once you do, then you realize that it's sort of like jumping into the pool the first time in the spring, right? That's too cold, but once I get in, it's wonderful.
Well, I remember I'm an Army brat. I spent the first 17 years of my life in the Army, so the term we like to use is putting yourself in harm's way.
Uh-huh.
Be ready to go in harm's way here.
Mm-hmm.
This is the same thing as going into the danger zone.
Yes, yes. Well, and to me, I'm with you that is where American business is today. We have people who have entered into the danger, put themselves in harm's way, made themselves vulnerable, be open to the change. We have people who are considering it, and then we have other companies who are totally unaware of those possibilities and are frustrated, limited, hitting the ceiling, and not making very productive decisions.
Yes, yes, exactly. And I think that one of the things is that what I love about the word courage is it's really heart. What I've found is that when an executive or an employee or a family member really finds their heart, really goes into what matters most, and this goes into your core purpose in life, why you're here, what really matters the most. When you really remember that, it allows you to access the courage to face and go into the danger zone, to put yourself in harm's way, to do what you know is right. you know, people talk about integrity, and integrity doesn't exist without courage. When you do the right thing, Will, when it's easy, that's not integrity. When you do the right thing, when it's hard and you're likely to be punished, that's integrity. And that's one of the big issues we have, too. We have CEOs and organizations that lack integrity. They might dish out the truth as they see it, but they won't listen to someone else's truth. Well, that damages integrity. If I listen, but I won't share what I see, that damages integrity. And if I'm not willing to hold to our core purpose and our true values, then we have no moral compass. And there's a number of organizations right now that are really fluctuating in very dangerous ways.
All right, so how do you approach them? I mean, I'm going to put on my sales hat now for a moment and ask you about, you know, I'm assuming they're not lining up outside your door right now begging you to come in and help them.
Some will. But I'd say in terms of all the consultants and all the work that's possible, no. I'd say that we're only probably the top 5% of organizations are ready to do the kind of work that's necessary to help them be high-performance organizations.
So how do you present yourself to them?
Well, the first thing is most of our work comes from referrals from CEOs to CEOs or senior VPs of HR or OD to others. So it's word of mouth, mostly. And what we do is our elevator speech is real simple. Look, we will help your organization perform, build high-performance teams by liberating the purpose, the passion, and the power embedded in the human systems of your organization. We've been doing it since 1990. We have a process that works, and we do it by really listening to you, understanding your strategy, what you need, what you want. We partner with you. We strategically align all work. And then we have a holistic and deep understanding of what creates great leadership. We blend IQ and EQ insights. And then we facilitate learning experiences that build high-performance individual leadership as well as collective leadership and high-performance teamwork. Do you believe your organization is functioning at its level best right now? Do you get the sense there's something more this organization could do? Do you believe that you've really mastered all aspects of leadership and that there's no room for improvement? So we ask some questions, and we mostly listen. And before we start talking about what we do or how we might help them, we customize what we do based on what we hear is going on with the client system. Because we have a lot to offer, but most organizations can't accept everything we have to offer. It's a matter of fitting it in and making sure that we're going after a root cause rather than a symptom. Poor teamwork is a symptom.
That's for
sure. You know, poor quality is a symptom. Unhappy customers is a symptom. What's the root cause?
Right.
So that's the first. So if we get to a root cause discussion with a CEO or senior leader, they're going to want to work with us because we know how to help them address those root causes.
All right, so I want to take a break here and come back and talk a little bit more about how people make a decision to work with you.
Okay.
All right, so we'll be right back after a word from the sponsors for the Pilgrim on the 405.
Hi, time for another tip from the Sandler Sales Institute. Prospects want your information and expertise. Prospects have been trained by the vast majority of salespeople to feel entitled to your valuable information. Most salespeople are comfortable in coughing up their expertise for free. However, when the orders don't come and the prospect has shopped your information to your competitor, the salesperson has fallen victim to unpaid consulting. Before giving information, ask good questions. What does the prospect want? What is the urgency? What are the consequences of not buying anything? What is the decision-making process? Eliminate unpaid consulting. This has been another Sandler Sales Institute tip.
All right, so welcome back to the Pilgrim on the 405, where we've been talking to Dusty Staub, talking about courage and leadership and development in companies to help them become the best that they can possibly be. So, Dusty, we were talking before the break, we were talking about how you identify and open conversations with companies that might not be functioning at the top level that they could be in terms of their leadership. So what? How do people make decisions about working with you or decisions about becoming better in their leadership?
That's a great question. I think the first step is that we have good references and good word of mouth from other CEOs. That helps a lot. But if you're just walking in and it's a short meeting, the quality of the questions we ask, the qualities of the questions that I can ask a CEO, an owner, a senior leader, really establishes our competency. You know, the mistake most consultants make is they want to come in and tell you all the things they're going to do for you, and they're selling you a bill of goods, or they're selling you their process, or they're selling you on their services or other programs. I'm not interested in doing that. I'm interested in finding out what the issues and challenges are that the senior leader has or sees. What are the one or two things that might keep him or her awake at night? And there's a series of questions we like to ask. And the first 20 or 30 minutes is really asking questions and finding out where they are, what their needs are, what's going on in their organization, what are the hot buttons, are there any pain points, what are the opportunities. By the questions we ask and the follow-up questions based on what they tell us, we've established a competency with them, and they realize, okay, well, these people are interested in hearing, and they're really thinking. And then, based on what we said, so would you like to hear a few thoughts about whatever we just said? Then I summarize, or we summarize what we heard, give it back to them in a very short, condensed form, and we say, and we have a couple of things we could do that could really help you right here. Would you like to hear about it? And the answer is always yes. And so then we start laying out a process. We let them ask any questions they want about how it works. And then we engage in some creative problem solving with them. So we create with them the path forward, and they it usually engage us at that point. About 85% of the time, walk out of that meeting, and we have a sales agreement on how we're going to move forward. And here's an interesting thing, Will. The client organizations that we have keep inviting us back. They invite us back because we help them solve real problems, and as they grow, they go out of the pain and they go into a new mode that says, hey, things are pretty good. Can we make them even better? Can we make them great? And the stuff we do really works even better from that stage, because mm-hmm. it's a lot easier to go from good to great than it is from not so good to good.
Mm-hmm. Well,
and so our average length of stay with a client system, once we start working with them, is 10 years.
Uh-huh. So now, in this process, does this extend throughout the organization to every member of the organization?
Not always. It's our preference that it does. If it's a small enough organization, it's very easy to cover everybody. Small entrepreneurial shop, it's very easy to do that. In some organizations, it's the senior leadership team, and then it's the key departments and the building high-performance teams, and then cascading down.
Mm-hmm.
One of our clients right now is a large multinational, international organization, and they have us, they're sending people to our premier three-day leadership program we do, open enrollment program. They ask us to create an in-house program specific to them, so we're now doing 6 in-house training programs where they're putting 16 people at a time in, because they wanted to get a lot of their talented people trained much more quickly. And we have also been working with them on building high-performance teams in 6 critical departments. So the plan is to cascade it all the way down to all 2,000 employees ultimately, but we're working probably with the top 500 right now.
Mm-hmm. What is your target market? Where are size of companies that you work especially well with?
Well, anything in from the $50 million up to the $500 million market works really well, because we can usually have access to the CEOs and the senior leaders.
Mm-hmm.
But we've also worked with some $50 billion businesses, and we've worked with some small mom-and-pop startups that are mm-hmm. probably right around, $1 million a year.
Mm-hmm. Well,
so,
we find that the target market for EOS companies is, we see it in terms of employee number, it's from 10 to 250 employees, that's the place where there's a real inflection in movement from I know best, you just go do it, to right. How are we going to solve these problems together?
And I would say our space then would be 15 employees to 2,000.
Uh-huh.
We work really well in that space. When you get much beyond 2,000, it's very hard. And so what happens is we get caught up in divisions of a large multi-billion-dollar business, and that division performs well, but we didn't get the CEO involved. And so you have one division that's an anomaly compared to the rest of the organization.
All right. Now you probably got
that's not ideal.
Probably have the crab bucket syndrome after that, right?
Yes.
You guys can't be doing that well, so let's see how we stop you from doing that, because you're making us look bad.
Exactly. We were once working with an organization where a CEO had come from Gould's Pumps, a Fortune 500 company, and he said, Dusty, we have some challenges here in this business, and it was a startup. He said, we're rapidly growing, but we've got to get our productivity up, and I want to really work on with my senior team to get them to be more of idea generators. And I said, great. So he brought us in and said, well, we'll work with the senior team, but we want to work with people on the front line, on the factory floor. He said, well, a lot of them don't even have high school degrees. I said, Steve, 85 to 90% of your breakthrough ideas are going to come from those people that are producing these systems for you. And that's where we're going to get all the productivity. We're just training you senior leaders so you don't stick your fingers in the machinery and mess it up. And he laughed at me, but he trusted me enough. And sure enough, they increased productivity by 50%. Profitability went up 55%. And they reduced costs by $300,000 on the manufacturing floor. And most of the ideas came from those people who they had not valued their ability to think. We just trained them how to think using a process we call bottom-line innovation.
Yeah, and you know, that happens so often with companies where the two or three people at the top believe that they've got the vision and they're going to tell everybody else what to do. And in fact, what they've done is they've hired assistants rather than managers, rather than people who are taking responsibility for things. And they wonder why there's such a lack of accountability, a lack of productivity. When we take the lid off of that, develop a leadership team, and then roll that out to the rest of the company so that everybody knows where the company's going, how it's going to get there, takes responsibility for the area, for the roles that they have in the organization, and perform those well, the productivity, it can't help but skyrocket, because you're actually letting people be human beings who have creativity, who have knowledge, and who want to help achieve the vision.
Absolutely. That's well said. And I'm going to say something really radical here that may piss off some of your CEOs or business owners. But I say, when you've been in charge of an organization for more than a year, and you look at your organization, everything you like in your organization, okay, I take a little bit of credit for, because it's the step-down reflection of your leadership. Everything you don't like, every problem you see, everything that's upsetting you, still going on, look in the mirror. It's a step-down reflection of an issue with you and your leadership. And when people get that and they realize, I need to look in the mirror and see, what do I need to do different if I want to get different results, and they work on themselves, then cascade that down, it liberates energy and passion and power. So absolutely.
Right. Yeah, and that's where I find it's essential for leaders to have coaches or maybe even therapists, but people who will help them reflect on their own ability. They will be the mirror for them. You can't shave without a mirror and do a good job. So you have to have this mirror to see what's actually going on. So I think that's essential. I think another essential piece for a great leader is to have a peer group, like a Vistage or a Renaissance Forum or Convene or C12, something like that, where they're actually meeting with, exchanging ideas with other like CEO people. And then having an operating system, like what you're talking about, because this becomes an operating system for the company, right?
Yes, absolutely.
This is how we do our business. And that's what EOS does as well. Have this operating system so that everybody in the organization knows how we're making this happen. and everybody knows what their role is, who they report to, how to achieve a greatness for their particular position in the organization, and then how to move forward, and to hear that fed back to them on a regular basis, the success that they're having. I mean, those three things, coaches, peer groups, and operating system, to me, are essential to making a business the best it can possibly be.
Yes, absolutely. And we like to call that operating system, we talk about leadership practices. What are the half dozen leadership practices that you want to see replicated in every supervisor and in everybody, all the way up to the CEO?
Mm-hmm.
And when you hire or you're promoting people, you're looking and inculcating them that operating system of these are the core leadership practices that really help us to perform well. Now you have a human system and a culture that is aligned around leadership and learning, and it takes courage to build it.
Well, let me move to a little different topic. Here in Orange County, Southern California, there are a group of people like myself, and we are dedicated to helping businesses become the best that they can possibly be. Because we believe that when we help businesses become the best they can be, that means that every one of their employees are becoming the best that they can be. And that rolls out to influencing how people work in families, how they work in nonprofit organizations, how they work in volunteer organizations. It produces more money as the productivity goes up for businesses. We're dedicated to helping businesses be the best. Now, maybe 10 years ago, we would have said we're dedicated to getting new clients because that benefits us. That competition for us is gone. We're now dedicated to helping companies be the best. And we know that out of the 100,000 companies that are here in Southern California, there's plenty of opportunity to succeed. So what would you say that we could do to help businesses become the best?
Oh, well, that's a great question. Let me give you a couple of thoughts off the top of my head here. The first one is, I would want you to be able to say to a leader, look, everything you see in your organization is a step-down reflection of what's good and not so good in your leadership. So let's look at everything you like, everything you don't like. Let's decide what's root causes. Let's do that together. And let's look at what you need to change. And very often, this is funny, for many of the leaders I work with, in fact, Fortune magazine, June of 1999, had a cover article called Why CEOs Fail. And there were two major reasons. Either they lacked the courage to confront a crony, somebody who'd been with them for a while, and hold them accountable soon enough, or they lacked the courage to be confronted by bad news down in the organization and they got blindsided, which is never a good thing. So it's going to require courage to really look at that. And so you say, do you have the heart to be the best you can be? Do you have the heart to have the best organization you can have? And the answer is that people, most of the time they're going to say yes. I say, it's going to be hard. It's going to be scary. And I'll be here to help you. I'll be here to talk to you through this and remember this moment that you've made this commitment. The second thing is we need to make sure we get high levels of engagement. That means we need to treat employees in a way that sends three core messages. And I think great leaders send three messages, really good messages here, Will. And the first one is you matter. You're important. If we don't make an employee feel that they matter, that they're important, that they're valued, we're not going to get anything from them. Second core message, what we're doing matters. The way we work, the work we produce, makes a difference in the lives of our customers, our clients, in the families of the service providers to our organization, and to your family and the families of your coworkers. What we do matters. We want to do it well. And only if you send those two messages in your leadership, in your practices, what you do and how you treat people, can you send the third message? And the third message is, let's create the extraordinary. Let's create an extraordinary level of working relationship. Let's create an extraordinary work culture. Let's create an extraordinary place where people can flourish, where people's souls can grow, where people feel powerful, where we are producing. We don't even worry about a competition because there's nobody to compete with us in what we do and how we do it. We build strong customer intimacy. We solve problems for our customers before they even fully understand them. And we are always there in terms of service because we care about each other, what we do really matters, and we're all about creating the extraordinary. And I think that if you can send those three messages and you can challenge the senior leaders to ask some of those tough questions at the beginning, and then they look at where they have courage and where they most need to develop courage, I think that can really help in the work you're doing out there in Southern California.
Right, now, let me ask you, do you think that it is possible? Can you imagine that CEOs and other business leaders begin to see these messages as something that they can say about the community, about the culture, about the marketplace?
You know, I do. I think I like to start, you know, like light one candle and get more people to light candles, and pretty soon you have a huge light. So I think it is very true. And I've been a certified forum facilitator for the Young Presidents and the World Presidents Organization in the past. And YPO, WPO gives you that kind of peer group you were talking about.
Mm-hmm.
But the best forums, the best peer groups in YPO and WPO are where people have the courage to be vulnerable, to admit they need help, to be open, mm-hmm. the courage to confront, to be confronted. And they also begin to realize they have the power in them to transform not only their family life, but to transform their organization by how they show up, what they model, the practices that they exhibit. And when people turn on to that and they realize that, well, it's just amazing what can happen. Everybody would rather make it better than worse. And yet look at where things are. It's how we figure things out. I said this as a psychotherapist. I said it as a marital family therapist. I say it as a consultant, as a coach, as an author. We're all doing the best we can based on how we got to figure it out. If we figure it out better, we'll do better. Our job is to help each other figure it out better for our families, for our departments, our teams, our organizations, our communities, and our society.
Yes. And I think that to me, the big issues today, we talk about being divided and split and all of these. It seems to me that that's part of what we want to recover, is that whole notion that we are responsible for everything that we see. The good, the bad, the ugly is because of who we are, choices we have made, which also means that we can make other choices.
Yes, yes. And I can make a choice to be happy and joyful in spite of my circumstances. Viktor Frankl showed that.
Yes,
concentration camp.
Absolutely.
Nelson Mandela showed that. So for me, as I say to everybody, look, it's the state of your mind, it's how you run your mind, the tone and quality of your heart that determines everything around you. When I address that, it can't transform my relationship with my father, transform my relationship in the world. And I've seen it and helped people do it, and I've seen it and been inspired by it, seeing others do it. And it's really the tone and quality of our heart and really being conscious of what we're doing in our minds and the choices we're making. And expanding our perception. I think that's really the key.
Yeah, absolutely. It's not about being better than somebody else and letting them be worse. It's not about getting more, they get less. It's not win-lose. It's how to be the best we all can be.
Absolutely. Well, well said.
Thank you so much for being part of the Pilgrim on the 405 and talking about how we can become the best that we can possibly be. How would somebody get in touch with if they wanted to continue the conversation? Rusty, Dusty.
There's two websites. The business-to-business website is just stobleadership.com. And the website for just the general public is called theactsofcourage.com. Theactsofcourage.com and stobleadership.com. And then I've got four books. Three of them are on Amazon right now, and they're available too.
Wonderful. Thank you so much for being with us. I really enjoyed the conversation and look forward to many more.
Hey, Will, I really enjoyed talking with you, and thank you for the great work you're doing, and just keep it up there in Southern California.
We will do it. We will do it. Well, thank you, everybody. This is the Pilgrim on the 405 talking about how to help businesses thrive in California.
You've been listening to The Pilgrim on the 405 with Will Crist. To hear more of the programs in this podcast, go to www.willcrist.com.